On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Rick Archer, host of Buddha at the Gas Pump.
If you want to change the course of a river, let's say the Ganges, you couldn't do it really at the mouth where it enters into the Bay of Bengal. It's the whole river has already run its course by then, and it has a great momentum to it. But if you could go to the source of the Ganges, up in the Himalayas someplace, maybe you could send the whole river off in a different direction. The metaphor is meant to suggest that the more fundamental a level at which you can operate, the more influential you can be. And so we have to ask ourselves, what changes culture? What is it that really changes the way people think and the institutions that appear to be in control, the politicians, the corporations, and so on? I would argue that the lowest common denominator in all of human activity is consciousness itself.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, I again talk to Rick Archer from Buddha at the Gas Pump, really one of my favorite guests and one of my favorite people to connect to when we look at the bigger picture questions of what does all this stuff mean and where might it be going in terms of consciousness research and in terms of answering the questions that we talk so much about here on this show. So it's always a pleasure to touch base with Rick and see where his community of enlightenment seekers are heading and where what they're finding matches up with or doesn't match up with what the science and rational, logical folks are doing. And that's what I sought to do in this interview. I hope you enjoy it. Today we welcome Rick Archer back to Skeptico. Rick, of course, is the creator of and host of Buddha at the Gas Pump, a show you've heard me mention many times on this show because I think it provides just a really unique and wonderful insight into what's going on with enlightenment and folks who are seeking this alternative extended consciousness reality that we talk so much about on this show. Of course, we're going to get into that quite a bit. Rick is also a longtime TM practitioner, teacher, and a longtime student who still meditates several hours a day, which is to most of us commendable, even though Rick just, I think, sees it as a natural part of his life. And along with that, he also has a day job helping folks with their websites and getting their SEO on, which if you don't know what that is, don't worry about it. It isn't in your world. But anyway, Rick, it's great to have you back. Thanks again so much for joining me.
Thanks. And I should mention that I am not officially a TM teacher anymore. I was kind of booted out of the TM movement over 10 years ago for getting a little bit involved with AMA, the hugging saint. They don't like their teachers to sort of get involved with other gurus. but I still meditate, and I'm appreciative of everything I gained from my TM World Association days, but I'm no longer part of it.
Well, you know, that's interesting in and of itself. I'm not sure we want to jump there right now, but one of the things I really appreciate about your website and about your position in general is you are very eclectic, very open to a lot of different practices and a lot of different techniques, but you're not afraid to kind of be at least a little bit discerning and critical about some of the dogmatism and fundamentalism that can emerge in these places where we don't expect to see it. I mean, non-duality people, TM people, they're not supposed to act like that. But of course, the human nature, I guess, crops up over and over again. So maybe in there, you can roll that into talking about Buddha at the Gas Pump for those people who maybe don't know about it or haven't listened to that previous interview. You know, I just heard an interview you gave, and it really, you kind of turned the tables and you were the subject of the interview, but you really talked about the humble beginnings of the show and how it just emerged out of this, hey, there seems to be a lot of people I'm talking to that are into this stuff. Let's get these ideas out there and see what germinates from it. Is that pretty much what happened?
Yeah. You know, I don't know exactly what puppeteer is pulling our strings, you know.
Right.
But you know, you just feel inspired to do something, and you don't know exactly where it's heading or how big it might become, but you just kind of follow the impulse. And that's kind of the way it was with this. It was just an impulse. And I started out thinking very small, like I'll just do this on the local radio station for the folks in my town. And that wasn't getting met with success. It was being resisted. And so kind of one thing led to the next. And as soon as I had the intention to make it a much more of a global thing, it got tremendous support. And, you know, it was like, that's what God wanted me to do, or nature, or whoever's pulling the strings. It's like, okay, now you're on track. Now here's some support, you know? And so it just kind of started expanding and growing. Yeah.
So then maybe we, because we know each other and we've become friends and I have great respect for you, maybe we're jumping a little bit right into some inside baseball. Let's back up. What is Buddha at the gas pump? How do you describe it to people who really don't know anything about it?
I just say that it's a show in which I have conversations with people who are awakening spiritually. I hesitate to use the term awakened because I don't know if I've met anyone who is as awakened as you can possibly get. So no matter how awakened they may be, and we'll probably have to define what we mean by that, there's still an unfolding of greater depth and clarity and so on. So let's discuss what awakening is. You know, if you ask the average person who they are, they're probably going to give you their name. They might give you some aspects of their personal lives, like their family and their job and all kinds of things that describe outer attributes. Maybe they describe their body. I'm a weightlifter. Or I'm a pro athlete or something, if that's what they are really, inspired by. But all those things are changing and dying. Spiritual authorities and mystics and so on throughout history have said that that's not who we are. We're something much deeper than that. You know, we're not merely a wave on the ocean. We're the ocean itself. We're at our core, at our essence, we are pure consciousness, unbounded, pure awareness. And that's our core identity. That's who we are ultimately. And there's only one of us on that level. You know, you and I are the same person, so to speak, on that level. And it's not even a person. It's sort of the ground state of the universe. So the whole deal with enlightenment and awakening and all that is to arrive at an experiential verification of what I just said. It's not a concept. It doesn't do you any good as a concept. You can conceptualize it till you're blue in the face and it's not going to impact your life. But actually getting down to experiencing life in that way is the most dramatic and profound thing that a person can do, in my opinion, and it has the most profound impact on life that anything can have. So anyway, that's what awakening is in a nutshell, and my goal in doing this show is, well, first of all, I just love doing it, but also just to sort of make people aware that there's somewhat of an epidemic taking place in terms of this type of experience that I've just described, and it's accessible to everyone, not just some guy sitting in a cave or, you know, some great famous saint who lived 1,000 years ago. It's accessible to everyone. It's your birthright.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all interesting. And let me in, and maybe this will be useful for people and useful for you and I. It'll be interesting to us anyway. But, you know, I kind of come at your show slightly differently. You know, I see what you just said at the beginning in terms of awakening, and I like the way you kind of phrased it. The term I would use is, it's the working hypothesis, right? So the working hypothesis is that there is this self, there is this unbounded self that connects all of us, and it connects with all these other wonderful insights and this other wonderful experiences. But that is a working hypothesis. What I love about BatGap is I get the spirit of exploring that you are exploring that as a working hypothesis. So there isn't the dogmatism that we'd see with someone who says, oh no, it has to be this brand of Theravada Buddhism as practiced in Sri Lanka in the 1800s. That's when it all happened. I mean, you really are not kind to that kind of, in a very gentle way, because you do a great job in your interviews, but you're not kind to that kind of thinking. You're just kind to kind of this scientific approach almost in terms of juxtaposing all these different people that are seeking this same experience and putting it out there and letting the chips fall where they may. What I think is interesting about that from a skeptical perspective, where we're coming at it, is that your working hypothesis is completely contradicts the underpinnings, the foundational ideas of our science, of our culture, of our belief system, in terms of, as you know, and as I say on this show all the time, the fundamental building block of science is that you are your brain. Your brain and your mind are one. You are therefore a biological robot, like the t-shirt.
You got the t-shirt? Good.
You sent me, and I sent you a picture of me wearing it. But Rick went to the Science of Non-Duality Conference, which we want to kind of segue in and talk about, because that conference represents kind of a community of people, of like-minded people who I think share some of this ethos that Rick is kind of tuning into. But I'm babbling on here. Tell us what you think about the juxtaposition of that idea, your working hypothesis, and the biological robot in a meaningless universe hypothesis? Or do you not even worry about that?
No, I don't worry about it, but I have some thoughts about it. I like the term working hypothesis because it fits right in with what I just said a few minutes ago, which is that this whole thing is really an experiential matter, not a hypothetical or conceptual or, you know, theoretical matter. And it's fine to form hypotheses, but then they should be experientially explorable and verifiable. Otherwise, it's just pie in the sky, meaningless belief. And, you know, belief might be inspiring to some people, but it really is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about direct experience. So now, as far as science is concerned, a lot of scientists think the way you've just described, but there are more kind of leading edge scientists, such as the ones who would come to that conference, who have definitely gone beyond that sort of thinking and are very eloquently arguing that, you know, we are not just biological robots, that we're more like, you know, that we're more like radios, which pick up, which can kind of pick up or detect an underlying field, which is vast and universal. The music is not in the radio. The music is kind of coming from, you know, vibrations in that field. So like that, what we essentially ultimately are is unbounded, universal, and our individual nervous systems are conduits for that, or channels for that, or sense organs of the infinite, you could say, through which we have individual experiences. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's just the sort of more. And so there are a lot of scientists who would agree with what I'm saying, and who actually can argue much more eloquently than I have in terms of physics and so on, why that is actually the case, and not the sort of more antiquated worldview that you just articulated.
Okay, that's maybe another topic for another time. I mean, I just think the number of scientists that really fall into that larger group, into that group that we're just talking about in terms of enlightenment and science and non-duality stuff, are really so small, and their influence is so minuscule, and they're so swamped by the other mainstream view that I think it's a mistake to see progress there when we're in this little community, this little echo chamber, and we keep talking to the same people over and over again, and we think that means that there's some big movement, and I'm not sure it's there. You know, the great thing about the internet is we have this long tail, which is a wonderful long tail, but that's where we're at, Rick. We're way down here on the end of the tail, and, you know, as I talk to the people at the leading universities, you know, the Ivy League people in the Oxford and Cambridge and so on, they don't give any time to any of this stuff. I'm barely a mention, and as a matter of fact, the counter to this, the antagonism towards these ideas and this woo-woo and this science stuff is really grown more in terms of, you know, numbers, has grown or at least is growing and still growing as much as this alternative community of enlightenment science seekers. I mean, that's my sense. And the numbers, I think, bear it out. I mean, if you want to look at like numbers of listeners, viewers of your show, of your fantastic YouTube channel, batgap.com, you know, compare that to Skeptic's Guide to the Universe or, you know, some other skeptic show. You're dwarfed by that.
Yeah, but that doesn't intimidate me. I mean, there was a time when the people who believed the Earth was not the center of the solar system but in fact was just a planet going around a star, were in the tiny, tiny minority, and they could get killed for expressing their opinion. But obviously, hardly anybody thinks that way anymore. So everything changed. It took maybe a long time for everything to change, but the pace of change seems to be accelerating these days. And I would argue that well within our lifetimes, the perspective that I just articulated will become the dominant theme. And but I may be wrong. Yeah. You know,
I mean,
who knows?
I just don't know. That's all fine to speculate and all that. Give me some data. You know, I just gave you some data, and I said, you know, this whole skeptical thing, which is just spreads like wildfire on the internet, or you go to something like Reddit or something like that, or Wikipedia. I mean, the Wikipedia was what, the second or third, fourth largest website in the world, dominated by that view. Dominated. You cannot get a word in edgewise with those people. So, you know,
you're sort of devoting your time to locking horns with them. I don't actually pay any attention to them. I'm kind of in this other world, you know.
Well, I really don't. You know, I mean, I split my time. I just think we got to kind of be reality-based. And maybe that's a way to segue into this conference that I think is interesting, because what I wanted to explore with you, let me back up and say, as you've heard me say many times, I'm a big, big supporter of Bat Gap. I think it's an extremely important show, and its importance goes beyond this community of people seeking enlightenment. I think it extends to all sorts of people who just have this yearning to know, is there something more? Is there anything more? And I think what BatCap does is say, oh yeah, there's a hell of a lot more. There's this more, that more. There's 50,000 flavors. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but on your show, what, 200, 300, 400 flavors of something more? Pick your own. And if you go there, I think you can't help but come away and say, wow, can I really try and jam all that experience that you share? Can I really try and jam that back into this kind of scripted idea? You know, this I am nothing, you know, I came from nothing, I go to nothing kind of ideal. That's where I think Bat Gap fits.
Yeah. And I think if people are really locked into the materialistic worldview, they're not going to stick with Bat Gap too long, or it's going to drive them crazy, because, you know, week after week after week, there's somebody expressing on the basis of their own experience, the contrary worldview, that we are consciousness and that there's a vast range of experience available to us, and that we're just kind of on the crust, most of us, of the surface, and you know, you can dive deep and explore the whole kit caboodle. And, you know, that's my audience, and I don't try to – I mean, it's fun talking to people who are somewhat skeptical. I still like to get Sam Harris on the show, but
I don't know why, but
– Well, because he has an interesting approach, which is that
– He has a schizophrenic kind of approach that I think is interesting to explore, how folks can be wanting to stay one foot in this kind of absurd – materialistic, biological robot thing, which he wants to stay in. And at the same time, it's like a guilt thing. He wants to deal with the fact that he knows that's fundamentally contradicted by this other experience he has. I'm all for you getting him on. I just think it's rather, he's a kind of comical character to me.
Well, I find him interesting because of what you just said. It's sort of like he has one foot on the dock and one foot in a boat, and the boat is kind of floating away from the dock, and at some point he's going to fall in the water, you know, because he's an ardent Buddha, a meditation practitioner, and it seems to me that if his meditation is fruitful, it's gotta kind of show him at some point that the materialistic worldview is unfounded, and he'll refute it through his own experience. And he insists on direct experience as the final arbiter of truth. He feels like a lot of harm has been done to humanity through believing things that we don't actually and can't actually experience. And I'm with him on that. Anyway, we're going off on a tangent, but
except for his beliefs, right? Like all atheist, except for his beliefs, those are, of course, propelling mankind forward in ways that we can only imagine.
I mentioned the Deepak recently, and Deepak said he's a naive realist. You know what that means?
No, go ahead, tell me.
Well, I'd have to look it up again on Wikipedia, but basically it's someone who does believe that the external world is real and, more or less as we see it. And that it has a sort of an intrinsic or inherent substance or reality to it. And, the cutting edge of physics says otherwise. So, like the other scientists that you mentioned, that the predominant scientific paradigm seems to be clinging to a worldview that the leading edge of physics has, refuted nearly 100 years ago. It's just taken a while for the rest of them to catch up.
So what are the prospects then for this community that you are a part of and you see growing and is represented in the Science and Non-Duality Conference that you went? And I'm hoping you can kind of bring us up to date on what that conference is like. I know you're not officially representing them by any means, but it's just kind of an interesting touch point to kind of talk about. What is it about this community? What is the non-duality community that you are a part of? What is that all about?
Well, I'd say the first thing that pops to my mind is that most of the people who attend that conference are kind of same as I am, as you described earlier, in terms of being very kind of accepting of all the different viewpoints and perspectives and so on that are presented. There, you don't really find anybody arguing that my way is the highway and all you other people are wrong. There's a real appreciation for the multifaceted nature of human experience and the fact that we've all sort of got a feel of the elephant that's a little bit different than everybody else's feel, if you know that metaphor. And so there's kind of like this diversity and unity kind of quality at the conference where you have all kinds of spiritual people. I even smelled a little marijuana at the last one. and all sorts of scientific people and poets and musicians. I mean, just a real potpourri of different types of people who are, on the surface, in terms of their backgrounds and their activities, apparently quite different from one another. But there's this kind of underlying unity or harmony that seems quite predominant. And so the atmosphere is really rich and very energetic. I mean, there's a lot of Shakti in the air. I can only sleep a few hours a night when I was there because there's just so much energy in the place. So it's very kind of, and there's about five or six things going on at once most of the time during the day. So unless you have the bi-location city, you have to kind of choose to do this, that, or the other thing. But anyway, it's a lot of fun. There are other conferences that are held here and there throughout the world, but I don't know of anything that's quite as big as this or quite as diverse and has such an interesting collection of people at it.
In a broader sense, what do you think is going on with this enlightenment community, I guess if we can call it, that you are a part of, that this conference is a part of? You seem to be very optimistic that it's really not only pointing in a new direction, but has some momentum behind it and is changing our culture, our view on science, our view on religion. What are your thoughts on that?
I do, and maybe it's just my own wishful thinking, but I really feel that most major social trends were not foreseen by the people who were living in any particular age. No one in the 1800s could have predicted what life would be like now, for instance, with all our technological advancements and all sorts of other things, gay marriage. I mean, just all these different things that are becoming kind of the norm now have become the norm. And I think that the most significant thing of all in human life is spiritual development or spiritual awakening. And it's been some, you know, and people have been interested in it. I mean, all the religions are faint remnants of revivals of that experience, which are, you know, were soon distorted and corrupted and turned into, you know, just belief systems. But I think that there's an awakening taking place now, which is unprecedented. And someone said the next Buddha is the Sangha. The Sangha means like the community, not as opposed to, you know, some one individual. And it seems like, you know, the communications we have available to us now have, for the first time in human history, made it possible for a show like mine to be on the air, or yours, and for there to be a kind of a mass awakening, as opposed to just one that takes place in a small geographic region and that is, you know, eventually propagates around the world, but is pretty much lost by the time it has propagated. So there's this kind of epidemic thing going on. And there may be, you know, if you're aware of the 100th monkey story, where monkeys on, you know, one island began learning how to wash their yams and eat them so they weren't sandy. And at a certain point, when enough monkeys started to do that, monkeys on another island all of a sudden picked it up. So there could be, it seems to me there's something going on that can't be ignored and that is going to result in changes in the world that the average person doesn't see coming. It's not predicted on or discussed on the evening news, but there's a momentum building, which I think is unstoppable, and which at some point is going to kind of create a phase transition, a shift. You know the word phase transition. When water is at like what does water boil at? 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level. When water is at 211 degrees, it doesn't seem like very much is going on. It's just hot water. But as soon as it reaches 212, it starts boiling and turns to steam. You wouldn't have known that was coming at 211 degrees. So I don't know how close we are to anything really dramatic happening, or even if anything dramatic is going to happen. But I think it's altogether likely, and we could be closer than we think.
You know, I'd love to think that that's true. I have doubts, and part of my doubts, and I don't see this really being addressed by the Enlightenment community or the non-duality community, whatever term we want to use, is how would that work? I mean, I just don't see how that would really work given our culture, and I mentioned our science, given our religion. I mean, I think the whole notion of this deep awareness of consciousness being somehow fundamental, completely makes science an oxymoron. You know, it's jumbo shrimp. It's military intelligence. It's science. No, there is no science. There is no measurement. We're looking at through the wrong end of the telescope. That's what you're telling us. That's what the consciousness community is telling us, is that we're creating all this. Why do we need to try and jam it back into some scientific understanding? I mean, science is a process. It's not a position. I get it. It's a set of tools that we can use and apply to anything. I get it. But hey, science is also a cultural phenomenon. Science is what we teach our kids, what we know, what we talk about and write about in magazines. Why do we expect that could be merged with this greater awareness? I don't think it fits.
So you're saying, I mean, maybe I hear you saying that, you know, why are these spiritual people even bothering to interact with scientists? Why worry about their whole trip? Why not just pursue your spirituality and enjoy it? Are you saying that?
No, I'm not saying that. I think I'm saying, you know, we're both interviewers, right? So we're both going to answer each other's questions. I think what I'm getting at is, how would you run culture differently? And then really break that down. And what you wind up with is the same kind of goofy political squabbles we get into anyway. So when I hear people talking about a phase change, a transformation of consciousness and all that, I'm like, well, and what does that mean to you? Where does that lead? How does that get us in a different place? I don't see it.
Well, maybe what you're alluding to is the fact that all the there are so many entrenched things in this world. You know, I mean, you were talking earlier about scientific paradigms, and then there's the whole military-industrial state and governments, and you know, there's so many things that really seem to have a lot of money and a lot of power.
And let's break it down even further. There's racial tensions, ethnic tensions, religious tensions. This isn't a new phenomenon. This has been going on for thousands of years. How does any of this change? You know, even among the, you do a wonderful job of bringing together all these different traditions, but where you really go is kind of off the reservation, if you will. And a lot of people that have said, hey, you know what? Those traditions don't really serve me anymore. So I've kind of gone and done it myself. But now you're talking about, you know, from a global standpoint, just a small fraction of people that would ever conceive of making that kind of leap or have the ability to do it through their cultural background and their training and all the rest of that.
Well, there are a number of examples I could give you to illustrate this. I can think of three. In your heart, about 1% of the cells are called pacemaker cells, and they actually regulate the beating of the whole heart. They kind of keep it synchronized. In a laser, the square root of 1% of the photons, if they become aligned with one another, coherent, all the rest of the photons entrain with them, and the whole thing becomes as if one photon, one coherent beam of light. There are numerous examples in nature where a fraction of a certain population or group of things can actually have an influence on the whole out of proportion with their numbers. So there's that thought. Another thought to throw in is that another metaphor. If you want to change the course of a river, let's say the Ganges, you couldn't do it really at the mouth where it enters into the Bay of Bengal. The whole river has already run its course by then, and it has a great momentum to it. Maybe halfway upstream, you know, stretching the metaphor because it wouldn't be practical to actually do this, but halfway upstream, you could maybe change the course of half the river, and it wouldn't be as difficult as down at the mouth. But if you could go to the source of the Ganges, up in the Himalayas someplace, maybe you could send the whole river off in a different direction. So the metaphor is meant to suggest that the more fundamental a level at which you can operate, the more influential you can be. And so we have to ask ourselves, what changes culture? What is it that really changes the way people think and the institutions that appear to be in control, the politicians, the corporations, and so on? I would argue that the lowest common denominator in all of human activity is consciousness itself. And if you can have a relatively small number of people awake to pure consciousness and operating from that level, then their influence, their impact can be much greater than you would expect looking at their numbers. And the whole, you know, I mean, the rudder of a ship is actually a relatively small thing compared to the entire ship, but it can actually influence the direction of the whole ship. So I would argue that, you know, the more fundamental a level at which people are operating in terms of their conscious awareness, the more impact they will have. And as their numbers increase, as it appears to be happening, the likelihood of a major shift in culture in whole society increases.
Rick, do you think that is an opinion that's shared by most of your guests and other people in the community that you're talking about? Or do you think... I know there's a diversity of opinion because the other, I guess, opinion that I kind of, I guess, favor more is kind of more of a Gnostic sensibility of just, you know, this is not what this world is for. You know, this world is for people who basically are buying into the materialistic kind of run the planet as a resource kind of thing. And that, you know, don't get involved in that. Get involved where you can, but be selective about thinking that you're going to kind of sit on the throne, control the world, and you're going to do a better job than the idiots who are already doing it. The problem is ever, you know, it's who would ever want that job? That's the problem, is that no one who is even the least bit awakened would want to do that and take on all that entails. It's an impossible thing.
Well, first of all, I think a lot of my guests would agree with that, what I just said. Some of them would kind of shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know, and I don't care. You know, I'm just focused on consciousness here. But and I've heard some of them say that. But a lot of them actually do feel that there are social implications to all this, that it's not just sort of an individual exploration in one subjective experience, but that inevitably the individual is going to influence the society. But in light of what you just said, it's not that that spiritually enlightened individuals become some kind of, you know, controlling force and that their individuality in some way begins to call the shots. Rather, their individuality gets pretty much surrendered to universal intelligence and they become conduits for the will of God, if you will, or for the divine intelligence, universal intelligence, and kind of enliven that in collective consciousness by virtue of their own experience of it so that that can predominate more. If you read the Tao Te Ching, for instance, Lao Tzu talks about, you know, various degrees of government and you know, the ideally a government would hardly even exist or no one would know it existed because everyone would be so much in tune with the Tao that their action would be spontaneously in accordance with cosmic intelligence or whatever term he used. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. I'm not talking about some little cadre of enlightened people sitting behind a monitor kind of pulling the strings and controlling the world. I'm talking about something much more fundamental and organic in which the whole society settles down to a more natural and harmonious way of functioning by virtue of greater abundance of people who function that way themselves.
Nice. I love the idea. I don't think any of the people in power are shuddering at the prospect of that kind of a revolution happening. But
little do they know what is brewing.
Well, let's talk about something else that I think is an issue that I think is really, really interesting and I think central to your community and has direct implications of some of the questions we've looked at on Skeptico. And that gets back to this issue of experience, you know, because I think there's such a kind of interesting play that we have with experience, and in particular with experience and these tools of science that we're talking about, because experience can only get you so far in that it's your experience, and that experience takes on a deeper and a richer meaning when we look at it in the broader sense of other people's experience. So again, that's a wonderful gift that you bring to people through BatGap. And sometimes that comes up in some rather, I don't know, almost uncomfortable moments when you talk to people who are very fixated on the fact that their experience is it and their experience, you know, is the only one that matters. And you kind of gently guide them towards kind of other ideas, other positions that other people have. So I think that's it. I run into that too in with Skeptico. You know, you could go into near-death experience and someone will have a near-death experience, a transformational spiritual experience, and they'll go, therefore, this is it because this was my experience. And in those cases, I think it's useful to pull people back a little bit and say, well, look, we have some scientific data here. We've done some good scientific surveys, and we've looked at this across cultures. We've also looked at this through these other lenses, these other qualifiers that we can. What about this dance with experience and this willingness to let go of our experience a little bit in order to kind of bring in the broader experience of other people?
Well, if you compare the kind of people I'm talking about, like the kind of people who would attend that conference, for instance, with, people who are in various political parties or who are in various religions, who, you know, are literally killing each other over their certainty of their own correctness, you know, and their own, you know, the certainty of their own beliefs. There's a much more relaxed, light, easygoing sort of orientation among people who are actually having genuine experience of these deeper levels of life. I mean, the deeper and more genuine your actual experiences, the more universal you become in your thinking, the more accepting and you know, appreciative of others you become in your thinking. So, you know, I guess that sort of answers
and
your question.
And you're sure about that. I mean, you'd hold to that. I mean, that has some, you know, if you pull on that string too far, it kind of has some uncomfortable implications in terms of saying, well, this is best, this is a better path, you know, there's some kind of, and then it gets into moral, you know, there's some moral imperative that we're going towards, you know, and some things that make people uncomfortable that sound very unscientific then, you know?
Yeah, well, some people are that way. And, you know, there are non-dual fundamentalists who, you know, terrorize the chat groups and insist upon their rightness and are very critical of others and so on and so forth. So, you know, I would say regarding them that their non-dualism is probably much more conceptual than it is experiential. And that, you know, in my opinion, genuine experience does make one more broad-minded and accepting and tolerant and you know, and that's the whole problem with religion is that, you know, most of these people don't have even a taste of the experience that the founder of their religion was probably talking about. They're just stuck with beliefs, what they've read in some book. And so, you know, the awareness is very narrow and one is very rigid and adamant about one's beliefs and therefore they clash with everybody else's beliefs. But genuine spiritual experience, if you got together the founders of every religion in the world in a room and had them have a chat, they'd probably just be having a grand old time. There would be complete, you know, appreciation and agreement upon what, you know, their various perspectives.
See, I don't know. I get what you're saying. I don't know if I totally agree, because I think there's a whole flip side of that too, and it gets at a question that I think gnaws at me, and that's that, you know, how does Christ consciousness continue? This is one question. You could rephrase it many different ways for other different spiritual traditions, but since we're in a Judeo-Christian kind of culture, you know, how does Christ consciousness continue to shine through these kind of goofy religions that form about it? And I think there's some goofy religions that seem very mainstream, and there's some other goofy religions that we know are goofy religions, like Mormonism. I mean, you just have to go back and look at the history, and this guy, Joseph Smith, we still have his criminal records when he was arrested for, you know, going and pulling this same seeing stone scam with other farmers before he even, I mean, all this stuff is in the record books. But let me get off of that, because the point I'm making is that despite all that, it does shine through. I mean, so it's almost the flip side of what you're saying is that, you know, if you practice earnestly in any one of these traditions, some form of this enlightenment does seem, in my read of it, to seep through. And I guess that's one critique I think I'd have of the non-dual community, the non-duality community, is this, you know. You're right. And the broader-minded people, they don't say it, but the appreciation for that there's different levels and ways of awakening, and there isn't like this perfect awakening, you know. And everyone's trying to integrate whatever awakening they have with the rest of their life, which is really the trick of it. And that, yeah, there's a lot of people that are caught up in what seem to us to be goofy religions, and they're still making progress despite all that goofiness. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, in the name of broad-mindedness, I would say that, you know, if people are in what we would perceive as a goofy religion, then it's probably the right thing for them at that time, for at their level of consciousness, at their level of spiritual maturity. And if they, you know, evolve or mature spiritually to the point at which it's no longer relevant to them, then probably they'll find something else. And you see that all the time. People are, they've grown up in a fundamentalist cult or something, and then they, at a certain point, they said, this doesn't sit with me anymore, and then they've gone on to other things. And a person might spend their whole life, you know, thinking that way, and, you know, holding up placards saying God hates fags or whatever, you know, like that guy in the Westboro Baptist Church. So, you know, they're always going to be nutcases. But, you know, we're really talking about apples and oranges to a great extent when you compare people in fundamentalist cults, such as maybe ISIS or whatever, with sincere spiritual seekers who really have an experiential orientation and are not hung up on, you know, what it says in some book or whatever, but are really earnestly exploring deeper levels of consciousness. They're worlds apart.
Oh, but Rick, isn't that the problem that I was alluding to? Are they really worlds apart?
I think there's a vast spectrum. Let me put it that way. Maybe they're all on the same spectrum, but it's a broad one.
Okay, so now put yourself in a position of power or control that you want to be to change the world, and tell me how you slice and dice that, how you legislate that, how you enforce that diversity, or how you promote the right way of being. I don't know. I don't know how you do it.
I don't think enlightened people would be into enforcing mentality. I mean, if you got Eckhart Tolle and Adyashanti and, you know, Francis Lucille and some of these spiritual teachers, they don't have an enforcing bone in their body. You know, it's just not their trip. It's not their dharma. I mean, there may be political leaders who will want to, because it's their dharma, who will want to be working on legislation and this and that, but they are governed by collective consciousness.
Yeah, but this is, and this goes back to the conversation we had before on Skeptico. Hey, buddy, there's always the Huns who are going to come galloping over the hill, and they're going to say, well, you can be accepting all you want, because I got something you're going to accept. It's my way, and that's the way we're going to do it. I mean, that is the reality of history that we've lived through. That's the only history we know, is of conquest and people who want to conquer other people. I don't know how you think we're going to somehow transcend that when, at the very moment that we're talking about, you have this experience with all these wonderful people who are enlightened, and at the same time, we can just turn on the news and see a bunch of people who obviously aren't very enlightened. And that's always going to be the way it is. We're not, yeah. Not everyone's going to magically change.
I think it really depends on what the ambient level of consciousness is in the world as a whole. And, you know, I can imagine a world in which the kind of predominant consciousness is so high, so pure, that, you know, there just wouldn't be those elements to which you allude. But that is not our world at the present time. And I could bring up the point that perhaps, you know, spiritual people will sort of generate some kind of good vibes that will prevent them from being invaded by the Huns. But look what happened to the Tibetans in Tibet, you know, with the Chinese invasion. Most of them got murdered. So I don't want to give any simplistic or glib answers, but the broader principle, and we can take this as a working hypothesis, is that there is, you know, there's a certain, individuals have a certain level of consciousness. Groups have a certain level of group consciousness. Countries have a certain level of country consciousness. And the globe as a whole has a certain level of consciousness. And, you know, at our current level of world consciousness, it's quite inevitable and natural that there are all kinds of conflicts and slavery and all kinds of horrible things happening. Maybe not as bad as it was 500 years ago. There have been improvements, but theoretically, at least, we could imagine world consciousness rising much higher and having a much more ideal world, a much more peaceful world, spontaneously, naturally, with leaders and politicians and so on who just enact, legislation, if it takes legislation, that is in tune with a more enlightened perspective. But they can't do it if the world consciousness is low. You could put, you know, God incarnate into the presidency, and he wouldn't be able to do much if the general collective consciousness is low.
Okay. Let me touch on a couple other things that we talk about here inside of Skeptico, and I'm interested in terms of what your community kind of feels about. And that first would be UFOs and an extraterrestrial presence and an extraterrestrial consciousness that really, if you're halfway honest about looking at the data, it's just the reality of that is inescapable. Not that I know what that reality is, but that there is some reality to it, and it is being controlled and hidden from us, to me, seems like just an inescapable truth. It's just what the data says. What are you in your community generally, how do they process that?
Well, I agree with you. I very much have that same perspective, and I've gone through phases of being very fascinated with that whole thing and reading books about it and everything. I definitely think there's something going on. I'd like to get Stephen Greer on the show or somebody like that at some point just to talk about the spiritual dimension of the whole UFO phenomenon. That would be my angle on it. I don't know what percentage of people I've interviewed would have an opinion about it or whether their opinion would resonate with ours, yours and mine. But that's my orientation. I think there's really something going on. It's very interesting. I think it has serious implications for the world and it, you know, spiritual development of the world, perhaps even the technological development of the world. I don't know how that's all going to pan out or whether we'll actually see concrete evidence of it in our lifetimes, you know, the proverbial UFO on the White House lawn. But I think it's exciting and I'd love to see something happen. I think crop circles are fascinating. I think a lot of them aren't explainable. Many of them aren't explainable by any conventional explanation. So that's a fascinating thing. I mean, you discussed.
I got my hat handed to me on the crop circles, so we got to shy away from that.
All right, stay away from that for now. But
yeah, it's an interesting thing. But let me interject there. Sorry to cut you off, but the crop circle thing. I ate my lunch, which is good. It's a humbling experience to go out and say, because I said the same thing you did, and I think I was persuaded that. I can't be too strong on saying that. There's a lot of evidence that the vast majority of them are man-made. And then once you get past that, what are you really talking about? It changes the whole discussion. But
okay. And I don't have an axe to grind on that whole thing. It's just, you know, I have a very layman's, you know, experience of it. It looks interesting. Looks like something's going on. But you could probably convince me otherwise. So,
What do you make? What's your gut feel for why there isn't more kind of concrete is maybe the wrong term, but solid experiential data coming back from your group about that? Why aren't more people
about what?
Why aren't more people sitting down, going to that plane of all-knowing existence and coming back and going, yeah, there's ET right there, and here's what they're saying. I know there's some very few people that do, but why isn't that more common?
I think it's a whole, you know, it's one thing to experience pure consciousness, but it's another thing to actually develop what they call siddhis, where you can explore and investigate subtle phenomena that are not apparent to the, you know, ordinary senses. And there are a number of people whom I've interviewed who do say that they routinely talk to or experience or perceive celestial beings and gods and other levels of existence. And that's very much congruent with my understanding of things, which is, again, like, you know, using the ocean analogy, that we're just kind of floating on the surface and that there's a vast range of subtle realms, and those realms are as populated with intelligent life as the, you know, world around us is. And I've interviewed a number of people who actually experience that routinely as you and I experience people as we walk through the mall. And maybe some of that life is extraterrestrial, and maybe some of what is sometimes thought to be extraterrestrial is actually terrestrial. It's just subtle. Among the whole community of people who are into spiritual stuff and into awakening and who have awakened, perhaps only a subset of those have opened to subtle perception. Most of them are just sort of into, you know, kind of at the self-realization stage without having developed the kind of refined perception that would be needed to experience these subtler phenomena or subtler beings and so on.
Great. And then I guess the final area that I just want to chat a little bit about is related in a way, and that's the near-death experience phenomena. And how do you think that fits into this layering that you're talking about, if that's one way to look at it, or just in general, what is your sense of what's going on there?
Well, Anita Morjani was my most popular interview of all time, actually. She has more views on YouTube than any of the other ones. And in any case, I think it's very relevant in a way, because it shows people, and people like Ibn Alexander, for instance, who were locked into a very materialistic worldview, that there's a whole nother world, you know, that is just kind of has been eluding us because we've been sort of you know, focused on just the gross phenomena. And so it's cool when these people have these experiences and come back to report them. And it's, you know, it gives people greater conviction that there's more to life than meets the eye. I think that obviously we wouldn't all want to have near-death experiences. There are safer and easier ways of tapping into the transcendent and you know, exploring these deeper realms of experience. But for some people, that has been their way, and it's been hugely transformative for them.
But don't we run into a little bit of a conflict in terms of the nature of the experience? In terms of, it seems like so many of the Enlightenment non-duality folks are going past, you know, keep going past to the kind of nothingness of being subsumed into the greater one consciousness stuff, which I don't kind of agree with that, but that's kind of not my position on all that, is that we just can never conceptualize that. You know, we have to bring it back and stuff it back into our mechanism here, and that's always going to be limited. It's always going to be a limited understanding of what's going on. But to the extent that we can, and we do, because we like talking, we like having these conversations, doesn't there seem to be some kind of fundamental conflict between what the NDEers are telling us and what the, you know, I don't know, Enlightenment community is telling us?
I suppose there might be in terms of some individuals within each of those communities, but there is no conflict for me. And I think I could probably introduce you to a lot of people for whom there would be no conflict. They would just fit it all together nicely. I think that your point about the nothingness folks, there are folks who sort of are heavy on the sort of nothingness and it's all an illusion kind of emphasis, but I think that's a phase. And, you know, I don't maybe it's a phase they'll be stuck in all their lives. I don't know. But I've seen a lot of people, if you were to ask me, you know, do I see some kind of evolution in this non-dual community, I would have to say that it's in terms of the word embodiment best sums it up, where people have kind of had a taste or perhaps, you know, total plunge into the absolute, abstract, unmanifest value. And then they're thinking, or then they're kind of realizing, yeah, that's great, but I'm a human being. You know, I have a life, I have a family, I have a job. How do I integrate that into my humanness? And so there's a lot of emphasis, and a lot of teachers are talking about it very specifically, on integrating that sort of nothingness value into the somethingness value, and being able to sort of bridge both worlds and live in both worlds simultaneously, being in the world but not of it. So in terms of the NDE thing, it really does give people a very profound taste, transforms their lives in most cases, makes them realize that, you know, we're this human life is just a brief kind of stop on a much grander journey. And I think that's a profound spiritual insight. But it's, you know, NDEs are not the only way you can get that insight. And I think people who have really gotten it in other ways would be very appreciative and accepting of any NDE person's story.
What's next for you, Rick? Where is Bat Gap heading?
Well, I just keep rolling along. There's a very interesting fellow named Leonard Jacobson next on the docket, and I've just finished reading his book and listening to a bunch of his audios, and I like him a lot because he has a very complete kind of understanding along the lines of what I was just saying. So far, I'm just interviewing one person a week, and it's you know, we'll see what develops. Possibly next year, I'll start doing two a week. We'll see.
Really?
Yeah. But you know, it's like I don't have a particular plan in terms of exactly where this is going. I'm just doing it and enjoying it and letting it unfold. And it hasn't always unfolded as quickly as I might like, but I think it's unfolded at a perfect pace. And there's a lot of great people helping, my wife, Irene, and I have a translation and transcription team of people that are around the world volunteering their time. And there's a guy who does all the video post-production, another guy who does the audio post-production. So it's kind of grown into this whole little community of volunteers and helpers and people. And I'm certainly not the whole kit and caboodle. I'm just kind of the guy who gets on the camera and gets on the microphone and asks the questions. But it's a lot of people kind of who are involved in it like that see the value of it, and the, you know, the, it's changed their lives profoundly, and so they want to participate in having it, you know, help to change others.
That's a great thing. So for folks who haven't checked it out, BatGap, BATGAP.com. Just a wonderful experience. You dip in there. I have to kind of offer a different perspective on something you said earlier about people who might go there and listen to a couple of interviews and then they're going to turn away if they're not into your thing. I don't know. I mean, even myself, I can think of years ago, I ran across BatGap and I listened a little bit, and it wasn't exactly my cup of tea. I don't know who I came across. You know, it wasn't you, but it was one of the guests, or it just didn't strike me. But it planted a seed, you know, and I think that's what you're doing. You're out there planting seeds, and you just don't know where those are going to germinate. But I certainly wish you the best of luck.
There's such a variety of people. I mean, if you listen to 5 or 10 minutes of one interview and it doesn't, you know, light your fire, then go on to the next one. I mean, you're probably not going to get through them all anyway, so why spend time on one that you're not enjoying? But there are some menus under the past interviews menu at BatGap. There's a alphabetical listing of all the people. There's a categorical. There's a chronological. There's also a categorical where we try to categorize all these people by their own personal background and also by their current teaching emphasis. So you might find that a particular category appeals to you and maybe not others. Another thing we'd like to develop is a kind of an events database where people could say, like, what's going on in London? And they would immediately see, okay, this teacher is coming on such and such a date, and this teacher is here, and so on. Or, you know, they could sort it and sift it in different ways in order to plug into something near them. Because we get a lot of inquiries from people like that saying, you know, do you know of anybody in Czechoslovakia? And it's really hard to remember. So if we get that set up properly, it'll be a real useful resource for people to connect with someone that, you know, inspires them.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, certainly wish you the best of luck with it, Rick. And thanks again. Our guest today has been Rick Archer from Buddha at the Gas Pump. Thanks again, Rick.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks again to Rick Archer for joining me on Skeptico. One question I tee up from this interview is, what do you think it takes for our society, for our culture, to experience a shift in consciousness and become more enlightened, if you will? So that's a topic we talk quite a bit about in this interview, and I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do that is, well, there's actually, let me stop and say, there's many places to do that. And one of the things I've been doing lately is trying to reach out a little bit more on Facebook, Twitter, and through my other website, Why Science is Wrong, that coincides with my book, of course, and try and connect with people in more and different ways, because that really is my goal, is connecting with you, the listener, and forming our own little community and helping inform each other and helping each other grow. So I'm looking for more ways to do that, including YouTube, which I'm kind of trying to expand that channel too. So I do encourage you to connect with me. I'd love to connect with you in any way you can. Like me over on Facebook. Please, please, please do that. Follow me on Twitter. I'm going to be more active on Twitter, so please do that. It's just a click, and I found it to be a great tool. I've used it for a while, but I was never really into it very much, and now I'm going to try and get more into it. So if you want, connect with me over there, and it's a good way for us to stay in touch. Of course, the usual ways work as well. Join me over on the Skeptico forum. Join me by writing comments right on the website, or you can email me. If you do come to the website, I should probably spell it out for you so you can get the correct spelling. It's skeptiko.com. And when you're there, you can, of course, find all our over 250 previous shows, all available there for free, download, MP3. Most of them are transcribed. Almost all of them are transcribed. And I should mention that as well. In the future, what I plan on doing is transcribing a little bit less, transcribing highlights, but in exchange for that, I'm going to offer links into the audio where you can listen to those parts. And one of the reasons I'm doing that is, one, I want to add that feature of highlighting different parts of the show rather than just providing one long transcript that I think is difficult for people to read through. I know that's how I would like to consume this information, so that's kind of how I do it for other people. And the other reason is I'm trying to shorten my cycle a little bit in terms of how long it takes me to get these shows out. And one of the things that holds that up is I send these shows out to transcription, and I can only do that after I've edited them, and then that takes a while, and then it takes people a while to transcribe these shows. So I'm trying to shorten that cycle down and get to be a little bit more efficient so that I can do more cool stuff. So those are just some little changes that you'll see coming down the road, and I hope they work out for all of you. And I hope you keep listening, and I hope you share this show with whoever you think can benefit from it. Well, that's going to do it for today. I do have a bunch of really cool shows coming up. I'm so excited about it. I have reached out to more skeptical people, and I have some pretty big names coming on the show. In addition to, I'm going to be going on more shows. I should mention that as I go on these other shows, I am posting those over on the whyscienceiswrong.com website, so you can go listen to those shows if you're at all interested in them. And some of them I've really enjoyed doing, and I think they have some good information that we don't always get out on the Skeptico show. But anyways, that's going to be there, and we'll also have a thread on the Skeptico forum that kind of discusses some of those interviews as well. So once again, that's all for today, but do stay with me, and until next time, take care and bye for now.